back to the last edition of our paper sessions, and I'm pleased to be able to introduce Professor Richard Stevenson, who's a professorial fellow at the Durham University. And Professor Stevenson is going to speak on an area that he has a particularly great interest in, which is historical observations, and he's going to be dealing with early eclipse observations.
What I'd like to talk about is partly where we've got in the way of studying historical eclipse observations to try to determine this parameter gravity, that is, changes in the Earth's rate of rotation. I've been engaged in this for quite some years. It started off as a PhD program and it's never really ended. So that basically is it here. Babylonian texts such as this have proved very, very valuable indeed for studying changes in the Earth's rotation in the long term. I will come onto those shortly. First of all, just a few pointers. The principal causes of changes in the length of the day in a decade sort of time scale, probably geomagnetic interactions between the fluid core of the Earth and the lower mantle, which is a very good semiconductor. And these have a typical periodicity of about 30 years or so on average, and amplitude something like 2 or 3 milliseconds. On the century time scale, it's possible that global sea level changes associated with climatic variations could be important, but it's almost impossible for us to evaluate what the scale would be. A few milliseconds, I would guess. But on the long term, millennia, lunar and solar tides cause a gradual increase in the length of the day by something like 2.3 milliseconds per century, and the rise of the land after the retreat of polar ice, which is still going on, causes a gradual decrease in the length of the day by about 0.6 of a millisecond per century. So we're left with a net increase of something like 1.7 milliseconds per century. And when I sometimes tell people that the length of the day 3,000 years ago was 0.05 of a second shorter than now, many people say, so what? Or how do you determine milliseconds when you're dealing with ancient observations? And the essential point is that what we actually have is observations going back to about nearly 3,000 years, and because something like a million days have gone by, each millisecond shorter than shorter than today, and therefore what we find is that the cumulative effect is really great, and that's what I want to talk about in the main. Just to get an idea, let me just get that reasonably straight. A composite of the Earth and the Moon to scale, not in distance of course, but the Moon is the principal cause of tides which are gradually increasing the length of the day. The trade wind patterns changing over the course of a year affect the length of the day by about a millisecond, the seasonal fluctuations. And if the retreat of ice, gradual retreat of ice after the last ice age, also is in fact changing the moment of inertia slightly. But I don't want to go into details now, ask me afterwards, you know, during question time, please. But finally, on the purely technical matters, some time scales and things like that. First of all, universal time, which is what really effectively people are measuring. You know, even in the ancient past, they may use local time, but it's very easy to reduce this to the Greenwich Greenwich Meridian by allowing for longitude and also the equation of time. So we can calculate, if somebody gives us the local time of the measurement of an eclipse, we can easily reduce this to UT, which is of course essentially the same as GMT. But terrestrial time is what we do our calculations in. And that's an ideal time scale based on the gravitational theories of the Sun, Moon and planets. And you can of course project this back into the past as far as you like, provided you know, and we use the Moon for this purpose, what the Moon's acceleration is. And this quantity delta T, which is so important, and we've already been talking about this today, is this Earth cumulative clock error arising from these changes. And it's simply TT minus UT. If you have an observation that gives a UT, we calculate the TT terrestrial time, and it's simply the difference. If we can build up a whole set of data, and then now something like 400 observations in total, we can actually then produce a graph showing how much has varied in the past. And the importance of that is twofold. A, in investigating the geophysics, but also, as of more interest here, how can we calculate retrospectively eclipses that happened in the past with as much accuracy as we would like to achieve? And what we need finally is to know the lunar acceleration and investigation of past eclipse records. And say we need this because they all involve the moon. And NDOT is what we usually call the lunar acceleration. The moon's retreating on account of tides at something like 3.8 centimeters a year from the Earth. This causes an orbital acceleration, which is really a deceleration, of minus 26 arc seconds per century squared, or the coefficient of T squared, of course, is half that. And that's sort of, if you like, some of the technicalities. Let's have a look at what the observational records are like. First of all, if we look at how delta T has varied over the past 400 years or so, we mainly use occultations to study this. This is the very long-term trend, which has a coefficient of T squared of 32, where T we measure from 1820, which is this is how we define the SI second, what the length of the day was around 1820. The mean parabola then is an approximation, but it wouldn't be any use whatever to try to extrapolate on the delta T curve over the last four centuries to see what it was like in the ancient past. But if we're interested, of course, in eclipses in the next few years, then extrapolation of the modern delta T curve is pretty helpful. But of course, for the longer term, if we're talking about several centuries, then really we ought to be thinking more of what the long-term trend is. But how, because I tend to think in the past rather than the future, how we're going to compromise is not quite so simple as that. But over the next 10 years, it'd be perfectly reasonable to extrapolate on the present delta T curve. But we should obviously kind of do this when we're working into the past. But once we get beyond about 1620, no more turnings of occultations, Clavius very fortunately in 1567 made a really interesting observation. And this which I've got a translation that I did here of it, which says essentially he's in Rome and the magnitude is 1.003. Fortuitously, he was right on the center line of this eclipse, and he says, apart from the day in which the moon is placed between my sight and the sun, it did not obscure the whole sun as previously, but a thing which perhaps never before occurred at any other time. A certain narrow circle was left on the sun, surrounding the whole of the moon on all sides. And I had a good talk with Eric Jones and people like this who observe far more eclipses than I'm ever likely to. And he suggested that what Clavius was seeing was the inner corona here, this certain narrow circle. But certainly eclipses are already starting, even as recently as 1567, to become important in this kind of pursuit. This is a view of what Babylon may have looked like for the Great Ziggurat, which is something like 90 meters tall, and it's possible, according to Diodorus Siculus at least, that the astronomers observed from the top. But whether they did or not, it's purely, you know, speculative. But what we do have are large numbers of clay tablets which were found at the city. And these, about 98% of them are in the British Museum. They were found in the 1870s and 1880s by villagers who were just digging up the site for bricks. And they came up, you know, on some of these buildings, which in fact have never been identified. So we don't know where this colossal site of Babylon they actually came from. But in fact, the British Museum did send an archaeologist out in the unearthed 50. But his records were destroyed by water, unfortunately. So although we know at least he was in Babylon, and therefore they do correspond exactly with these, we don't know precisely where they came from in the city. But this one, which is very, very well preserved, and sadly, this one, which is unfortunately far less well preserved, but contains much more detail about a total eclipse of the sun in 136 BC, which I have really published an awful lot about in books and various papers. But let's have a look at it again. So the larger tablet, which is very well preserved, gives a very brief record. It's what's called a gold year text. And it tells us that this eclipse began at 24 degrees after sunrise, which is 96 minutes, and it, after 18 further degrees, which is 72 minutes, it became entirely total. But the small tablet actually contains, which is a diary, contains a very full record of this, and it gives the same thing began at 24 degrees after sunrise. During the totality, Venus, Mercury, Jupiter and Mars were all identified by the astronomers, as well as some stars, and it tells us the duration of the eclipse from beginning to end was 35 degrees. So take from, we have the 18 from 35, and you get 17. That is measured to be 18 degrees to come to totality and 17 to the end. So we have pretty good agreement. When we come to look at the figures, what sort of geometry, this is where it becomes obviously specifically interesting. Quite some years ago I did an article in Scientific American on historical eclipses, and I still haven't found a better illustration than they produced from my very, very rough, very copy. And if we compute the track of totality in 136 BC, this is without assuming any change in the length of the day, this is where it comes over. Here's the site of Babylon. This is more than 45 degrees, so that the clock error is about 3 hours. If we allow for tides, it comes to the east of Babylon, so there are non-tidal effects too, such as I said, changes in the ice, as the ice gradually receded. But if we have a look at some of the numbers, which is the main thing, let's look at the timings first. When they measured the time of the start of the eclipse, we get the UT, we reduce that to 4.19 hours, we have the computed TT, and we find the difference is 3.5. When we come to totality, we get 3.36 hours, and we come to the end of the eclipse, that is 3.4, so they're pretty good measurements. Unusually good, as we'll see. But if we simply assume that the eclipse was total at Babylon, then we get delta T must be somewhere between 3.11 and 3.37. That is, of course, the delta totality has a very hard edge, and all we do is vary delta T to achieve totality at Babylon. Now, if not were the only observation that we had, then we might think, well, is there not something wrong with the record or the analysis? But fortunately, there are many more. And this is interesting because it shows not only one of the tablets we were looking at, the little white ones before, but some others as well, which are lunar eclipses. It shows you too what a bad state they're in many cases. You know, people at the British Museum at the beginning of the last century tried to join quite a number of, quite successfully. Here you can see where the spade's hit it when it's been dug up, for example. So there's an awful lot of damage. And we estimate less than 10% of the original archive is preserved today. And, you know, this is pretty sad. But if it had all been survived, I don't think we would have found the people to actually work on this. You know, I mean, you have too much, to a colossal amount of data. So maybe it's just about right. Karen Hunger, following Abraham Sachs. Abraham Sachs spent about 30 years of his life working on these texts, and after he died in 83, Herman Hunger took over. And it's only now, in the last 10 years, that Hunger has been producing the translations of the diaries. And there are 4 volumes have already been published, and the next one is just about ready. Well, Babylonians would time the beginning of an eclipse, first contact. If it was total, they would time when the moon just became total, the end of totality, third contact, time when the eclipse ended. So this is fairly straightforward stuff. I mean, just the sort of thing that people, in many cases, will be doing today. Here's just one example from 120 BC. It gives a date. And it says, this lunar eclipse, of course, it began after 24 degrees. So, first of all, we go to the end of the text, because it always says at the end it began at something after sunrise or sunset. Babylon has a very flat plane, almost completely level, So sunrise and sunset are fine moments for that. If the weather is clear, and the sky, there are no clouds in Babylon, May, June, July, August. In the winter months, it's fairly cloudy. And one of the things I've been thinking about doing is separate the summer observations from the winter observations to see if we, in fact, these are more precise, but that's something for the future. But it says, it began at 66 degrees after sunset, lunar eclipse. After a further 24 degrees, one ood, we don't know what that is, but it means a very, very tiny amount, black totality. I computed the magnitude, in fact, we went by 0.02, so it's just about. And it also goes on to say, this 60 degrees duration of that phase, that's 24 minutes, they didn't seem to notice any change, so I just took the mean of that. And then, and it began to become bright, and then after a further 24 degrees, it became bright from northeast to southwest, and it gives the total duration. This is broken slightly, but if you add the figures 24, 24, and 6, it's fair enough. So there's all sorts of restorations that we can do which are quite legitimate, like this. What sort of devices were they using? Maybe water clocks like this. This is an Egyptian water clock from 1450 BC, but none of the texts tell us what they were doing. There's some slight evidence of Babylonians using water clocks, but not anything like as much as we would like. Well, results. Here's a plot of delta T with the results of the observations we've known for a long time. And you can see generally there's quite a decline, but there's two sets of observations here which are clearly missed. Now, if you recall, the Babylonians were measuring the time of an eclipse relative to sunrise or sunset, and then after that they don't give us the durations. So if there's an error in the time of first contact, all the others will be offset. And this is what I suspect is the case here. But fortunately, the new set of data that we've got fills in a lot of details, as we'll see towards the end of the talk. But what I'd like to say is, we can trace the change in delta T from these observations back to 700 BC, but we have nothing before that from Babylon at all, and we almost certainly won't get it. But if we sort of say, well, let's try an experiment with the data, certainly when they were measuring times of 6 hours, as they might have an eclipse was near midnight, because they all time relative to sunrise and sunset, then of course you've got clock drift, could be quite serious by a very primitive water clock. And if you look at that, if you think back to that scatter that I showed you, they were suggesting they were timing to the nearest degree of 4 minutes, but they obviously didn't succeed. But what I did was to reduce all these to the very short-term measurements of 100 minutes or less, and you get almost, apart from this one, it's almost monotonic. Now, is it safe to do this? Probably not, because it was purely arbitrary to pick that and that number of 100 minutes. But what to Leslie Morrison, who I've worked with in much of this, and I've done is to actually double weight the short ones and leave the others a single weight. What about China? Only from AD 434 onwards, as late as that, do we actually get preserved timings of eclipses which are of any precision. And this is the very earliest lunar eclipse in China, the timing is for AD 434, and this is what this one is. And it gives times of the various phases, it gives the year, it's the 11th year of this particular rain period, 7th month, and it says the 16th day at full moon, and that's the moon was eclipsed. And there's some timings here. These are first of all the predictions, but then the observations. And it says in the fourth watch, the second call of the fourth watch, so there were 5 watches to the night, from dusk to dawn, and they divide each of those watches into 5 calls after the calls of the night watchman. So we go on, and I'll just the easiest way is to show you a translation that I did of this, rather than waste more time on little details like that. So this is the very earliest, as I say, and we have the moon beginning to be eclipsed at the second call of the fourth watch, and it says, let's forget the time because that's only rough. By the fourth call, the eclipse was total of the same watch. So those are the key figures. What about the timings? They computed that the eclipse would occur something like 5 to 7 in the morning. It actually began at 1 to 3. They were 4 hours out in their timing, in their predictions, which I suppose at this period, since we're simply using eclipse cycles, wasn't too bad. At least it would give people a chance, let's say, to prepare to watch for an eclipse, even though they were quite a long way out. But just to give some figures again, you can get from that that the UT was 17.65 hours, the TT was 18.14, so we get delta T is half an hour or 17.50 seconds, remembering that instead of in the VC period, we're now in the AD period. And the other observation gives, the totality gives 2,800 seconds. So we think one 1750, the other is 2,800. That's a huge difference. But after all, a fifth of a night watch was about half an hour. So 1,800 seconds. So this doesn't surprise us. This is why we need a lot of data. It's no good just having odd bits and pieces of data. Well, let's move on. The Chinese, too, we know were using water clocks. Rather like this one. It's a Han Dynasty, sort of 180 variant water clock. I've never seen the actual instrument. I presume that as the water level fell, because getting slower as the head dropped, they would make allowance for that. But I'd have to say I'm only guessing on that. And I'd have to see to be able to comment. One solar eclipse of the many that were timed. The first solar eclipse that was timed and accurately preserved today is from 85-86. And this is a total eclipse which is timed in 87-61. And it says, the symmetric eclipse, the large stars were all seen. And it gives the times of totality. They were using, for daytime observations, 100 marks to a day. So that is a quarter of an hour. So it is, the loss began as the eclipse first started at 6 marks, 6 curve, after this particular chin. And then it was total, and then it actually gives the details for the last contact. So one starts to get used to, as I say, that kind of observation, working with this sort of text. If we take the very early set of observations up to about 8700, these are lunar and these are solar. This is the one in 434, and it looks suspiciously like somebody got them wrong. But as I say, it's not sufficient to just take a few observations from one particular culture. This is going to be really intercultural. And I found the really good observations are from only four parts of the world, from East Asia, China, and also Babylon, Europe at certain times, and the Arab world, nothing from the New World or India, for example, or Egypt. So here we've got Chinese observations from AD 1000 to 1300, both solar and lunar. And we've got a gradual trend downwards in delta T, and you can see that the mean here is something like 1500 seconds, going down to half of that by AD 1280, which is when the observations stop. It's the end of the Yuan, the Mongol period of really active observing. From the Arab world, people were using asteroids to reduce their times, their altitude, to time. The Arabs in general preferred, instead of measuring time with clocks, which might be unreliable, to instead use altitudes, both of the sun or the moon, or sometimes certain bright stars. And what one can do is, they reduce these with an astrolabe. One can just simply take their figures, compute the various, what the altitudes were equivalent to. And here we've got an example, and this is 80,002. And it gives the date on the Hijra calendar as well as on the Persian calendar. And this is, it said it had a stain, which means it was actually total. The eclipse began when the altitude of Al-Simak, Al-Rahman, which is Arcturus, was either 12 or 52 degrees. The Arabs were often using, like the Greeks, letters with a dot over them to indicate numbers. And my colleague, Said, was very, very doubtful. But for the others, it gives for Capella 14 degrees, and then the altitude of the start, that's again Arcturus, was 35 degrees at the end. So we find occasional difficulties here, because in fact only this single manuscript exists, one version of it only. And obviously there are going to be mistakes or miscopying, all sorts of things, and you have to be aware of that. Fortunately, we don't always meet that problem. Well, with the medieval Arabic Fitz records, this is the situation we get, and obviously coming from about AD 800 to just over 1000, there's only over 200 years of data there, and we get a gradual, if you like, if we try some filling reduction, but David T was clearly in that period around about 1500 seconds or so on average. Well, as I said, that's fine. We can't improve that unless we incorporate different sets of data. And this is what I've spent a lot of time working on over a lot of years. And of course, like I said, often with Leslie Morrison. Here's the Babylonian data, plus a few Greek measurements made by Ptolemy and others. Here's Chinese observations, more Chinese observations, this is Arab data. And this is first of all the tidal parabola, and it's clearly, this is way above the mean for the data. First of all, we tried parabolic fit, and Leslie was brave enough, I must say, to say, let's go to the next stage and try a spline fit. The main thing really is, first of all, we can trace delta T changes with reasonable confidence, but there are obvious gaps. There's a very ominous gap here between just before the birth of Christ to about AD 400. Not very attractive gap here as well, around AD 700, and also after AD 1300 up to the time of Flavius. These are problems that we have to sort of live with and realize we may never fully resolve things. Now, one other alternative is to instead use untimed data, and here's several pictures of an annular eclipse, and it's just to remind us that if you take one of the Chinese records from 1292, it only doesn't tell you as much about the time, but what it says is something entered into the middle of the stone, so it wasn't complete, but the stone looked like a golden ring, which is a very, very neat way of describing an annular eclipse. But this is the only detailed record that I know of from ancient or medieval history where it gives a clear description of an annular eclipse in those words. Obviously, because annular eclipses don't attract much interest, many seem to have simply passed unnoticed, or not worth commenting on. Total eclipses, of course, it's a very, very different situation. I know of something like 75 or so pre-telescopic records of total eclipses of the sun, and I just got one or two examples. This one's only lately come to light, but it's in one of the many local histories, and we're not likely to find many more. Total eclipse in 1361. Gradually, it's assumed the shape of a plantain leaf, the sun. But the sky was briefly as dark as night, and the stars and the dipper shone brightly. In the time it takes to chew and swallow, it was as before, and the sky was bright again, and the stars and the dipper were also hidden. Then in a short time, the sun set. All right, doesn't tell us much about timing, but it actually is almost certainly an account of a total eclipse, where seeing all these stars, including the dipper. But I really take very great pains with working with these records. I much prefer the record to say the sun completely disappeared. To me, anything less than that is very, very suspect. This is a lovely record from Europe, and in 1133, and it says something like, what it's not seen in 1,000 years. Eventually the whole sky was dark like night, and stars were seen almost all over the whole sky. At length the sun, emerging from the darkness, appeared like a star, rather like the kind of thing we've been talking about, afterwards in the form of a new moon, and finally its original form. This is a lovely account, It's from a chronicle at Ravensburg, sorry, that's a little missed out there. And so we know the date. It's well preserved, 1133, and it's the Gnomes, the 40 before the Gnomes rose, that's over the second dead right. This is what we'd love to see more of, and this is what makes me very skeptical about going back into the more remote past. And one Arab record, which I'm very fond of, and maybe shown it to some of you I knew before, from Sisri, and this is by Ibn Athir, the chronicler, and he says, it eclipsed totally. The earth is in darkness, so it's like a dark night, and the stars appeared. Gives the date where he was, at Jazirat, that's now called Sisri. When I was young, in the company of my arithmetic teacher, when I saw it, I was very much afraid. I held on to him, and my heart was strengthened. He was 16 at the time. And my teacher was learned about the stars and told me, now we will all see this go away. And it went quickly. These are the lovely records that I did, you know, really like to see. If we then look at those records of total eclipses, then we can also see that each of this, let's see the one in 136 BC that we were talking about before, this one from Babylon, only defines quite a narrow range of Delta T. Each of these defines its own, but the agreement between the timed observations and the untimed is very good. But again, I'm very, very hesitant in going back much before, let's say, 500 BC with those. If for those interested in changes in the length of the day, then this is what we get. Average is 1.7 milliseconds per century over the last 3,000 years or so. This is what we'd expect from the tides. This is the first differential coefficient with respect to time of the spline fit. But again, the main thing seems to be how accurate can we define it? Well, many new records have actually come to light from Babylon, and what I would like to just show you is what sort of delta T curve that we get. And here it is. It's the same one we were looking at before, but all these black asterisks are the new inverted commas data. A lot here, quite a few here, and a lot around there. So this is the mean, which is 32 seconds t squared, and it goes right back. You can see it was just about 700 BC. In fact, these just before that recorded in Ptolemy's Almagest. Now the thing is, when I say new data, this is not newly discovered in fact, new tablets. It's simply kind of work that Hermann Hunger and others have been doing lately with the text, rereading them, translating them more carefully than before. But there are still quite a few more to come. Another 20 or so observations yet to come. And so we will never know the way delta T vary accurately, but what we can certainly do is to get a reasonably good fit. And that's, you know, what I'd like to almost finish with. What I wanted to point out too is there are quite a number of possible references to eclipses on the Oracle Bones, as we were hearing before. But a couple of points that I felt concerned to make. And one is the background. There's something like 160,000 pieces of bone that have been uncovered so far. And there are only five lunar eclipses on these. They're mainly divination texts, as was pointed out. Probable date ranges here, but no more than a single report is found on any one bone fragment. The year of occurrence is never given. And in one case, only in the month. So we're left with only the day of the 60-day cycle. And I feel this is, as I've felt for a very long time, we've got to be very cautious in trying to do this. So, let's just move on. What about the European astronomers, such as people like Tycho Brahe, Copernicus, and others? I got a student to actually do an analysis of these, including people like Regimontanus and Walther as well. And here's, I did this terribly crudely in a hurry, the actual delta T, the mean parabola. But we can see the scatter is huge. That is the kind of timing that people were doing, even Tycho Brahe in just around 1570 to 1600 was just not good enough. So we're not going to get anything from those. We've got obviously quite a bit to expect from the Babylonian data. But the other possibility is, what about European chronicles? And I got a contact in Montpellier who actually sent me a paper that he'd done in a journal, a local journal from that town, in the Chronicle of Thalamo. And this mentions four total eclipses. Three of them are 1239, 1385, 1415. I knew of another account from 1239, but neither of those. And this one, there's something wrong with the year, but this is definitely the Eve of Holy Cross is September the 13th, and the only one around there was total 1178 September 13th. And I'd like to see people who maybe have an interest in local history to come forward with stuff like like that from their own area. This is really what's wanted. And to finalise. This shows, although it may not be too easy to read from one of the few rows back, our revised Delta T results, which could still need some revision in the Babylonian era. And hopefully, if we ever got any further Arab data, which is unlikely, or some medieval European data, we might be able to refine a little more. But we can see, what we can do is we fitted spline fit to back to about 700 BC. We have no, in my opinion, reliable data at all beyond about 750 BC. And therefore, all we've done is to use a parabolic fit for these. Now, I've got three or four copies of this paper. It's appeared in this month's Journal for the History of Astronomy, this paper. I've got three or four copies with me. I've given them to already a couple of ones to people. If you'd like one, urgently see me afterwards. So, that's the situation as I see it today. I feel there's some scope with the new inverted commas Babylonian data, and there's probably the possibility of people looking through local chronicles, town and monastic chronicles from their own area. The ultimate hope is Arab data, but right now this is very, very difficult access. And, with Chinese data, I just feel it's unlikely that we're going to get much unless we really have some major archival plan. Thank you very much.
Time for a couple of questions.
Hi. You've got the tidal parabola, and then you've got your fit of the data. There's obviously a difference between them.
Yes, of course.
Has there been any kind of consideration by geophysicists or whatever as to whether that discrepancy is reasonable or what?
Yes. Artificial satellite data do indicate that due to the rise of the glaciated land, which is still going on after the last ice age, particularly noticeable in Northern Europe, for example, it gives about the right sort of figure. For example, we get a difference of about 0.5 or so milliseconds, and the artificial satellite data is about 0.6, so it's about right. But if I may just continue what you've said, I spent some time at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, about over a year actually, and trying to see if we could push this data back beyond 700, because a colleague there was interested in the rate of change of this J2 term, you know, which is of course due to the as the loading of ice decreases, the Earth the distance between the poles, of course, it increases, so that in fact the Earth becomes slightly more spherical. But it just wasn't on, unfortunately. But that seems to be the most reasonable explanation. But as for the wiggles, well, this could be changes in sea level perhaps. But the thing is, I attended a conference in Stockholm some years ago where I discussed what I knew then. And somebody there was quite keen on measuring global sea level. But in fact, global sea level changes are very, very difficult to measure. We can measure them locally, but globally on a period of centuries is a different matter entirely. So that isn't very optimistic at the moment. It could be sea level changes. It could be, as Peter Huber, who's a statistician, suggests, stochastic effects and random effects rather than where we can give it a real physical explanation. And of course the geophysicists would prefer a physical explanation. Mathematicians have different ideas about this. What I feel is my what I should be doing, if I may say, is instead of having an axe to grind, just produce some results and leave that to the others to sort it out. But maybe that's a very myopic point of view. I don't know.
Something is actually active in local history as well as in astronomical history and maritime history. I think that would like to emphasise or encourage you to look at local history records, not just for eclipses. I mean, for example, in the town I used to live in Faversham in Kent, there was alleged to have been a world record early observation of the lunar crescent. My friend John Zonecki was investigating the Evil Chronicle and reported a very strange solar phenomenon about 1150 or whatever. But how on earth are we to get the local historians to tell it? Because they don't go to these meetings. It seems to me it's very, very useful. Further example is the marvellous work that's been done on magnetic records from Kent Locks.
Yes, indeed, yes. No, this is really quite
how on earth do we tell the local historians we want to know?
When we had the IAU in Sydney last year, some of us on Commission 41, when I stepped down as president after three hard years, I don't mind saying, did actually talk about the possibility of setting up a group interested in looking for records and sort of actually taking down, essentially noting records of various astronomical phenomena. Now, I remember the first IAU I ever went to in 82, it was talked about then. Let's hope that 20 years on and more, we might get some progress this time. But seriously, I think this, I appreciate that very much. And I would really urge any of you, particularly continental Europeans, if you are aware of any kind of astronomical phenomena in medieval chronicles, or if you have a colleague in your own town who really has this interest, to really encourage them to do something about it. Because I really have to say, you know, I mean, it's only now and again that I get an interest from people. Most historians seem to have, well, generally speaking, very little concept of the importance of the astronomy. And sadly, most of the astronomers have either far more important things to be doing, or they don't have the linguistic expertise, like working with Latin chronicles or whatever. So thanks very much indeed for that.
Take one more question, Glenn
Schneider. Mr. Clifford, did I understand correctly that the occultation record only goes back to about 1600?
Yes, 1620. So, I mean, there are huge numbers of occultation records in previous centuries, but they don't give us times. This is the real problem. They only record the occurrence of something. Now, I had a shot, for example, there are many occultations of Venus recorded in Chinese history, vast numbers of them. And I thought, let's see if there's any grazing occultations in there, but it's you're obviously narrowing the number down considerably, because obviously, whereas a total eclipse is a very, very narrow band, and you're looking for a very, very narrow band, which is far less easy to observe at the edges of an occultation zone with the unaided eye. And I really, in the end, after a pretty hard struggle on this, just gave it up. So what we really would love are many, many timings of occultations, you know, going back as far as we could. When in the end, before 1600 or 1620, we're left only with the eclipses. And of course, the other two advantages, either people were so interested in these, trying to predict them in the future, and therefore people would record times of existing ones, or to check on the accuracy of the current eclipse tables, for example. Or, of course, the total eclipses, they're so spectacular that all we need is somebody to tell us that the sun completely disappeared at such and such a place, such and such a day. And it's you know, this is much more straightforward to deal with. And it's very, very sad, in fact, if I may say, that you know, we don't have the same interest in occultations timings. There are one or two, but they're very, very rare. And it really, you've got this huge corpus now, about 400 eclipse observations, and about half a dozen timings, and it's hardly worth even bothering with them. But that's probably a very negative attitude. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much.